I want to be clear with you all that a new day has come. To San Francisco, to Oakland, to Baltimore, to Ferguson, to Atlanta, there is a movement sweeping this country, and we are not going to stop until you stop killing us.
Shut it down! Shut it down! The time for the middle ground is over.
What's up, family? Today is Wednesday, July 10th, 2024. You're listening to Law & Disorder on KPFA Radio. I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. California's wildfire suppression planning leaves a lot to be desired. On today's show, we'll learn how our neighboring native communities are rejecting our state's militaristic approaches to fighting fires by stewarding relationship with it. My guests today are Denise J. Martinez and Tony Marks Block, researchers of and co-authors on an article called Indigenous Fire Futures, Anti-Colonial Approaches to Shifting Fire Relations in California. All that and more coming up after the news.
I'm Christina Onnested with KPFA News Headlines. Israeli airstrikes killed 20 Palestinians in central Gaza, including 6 children and 3 women, some of them inside an Israeli-declared safe zone today. The strikes come as U.S., Egyptian, Qatari, and Israeli officials gather in Doha for ceasefire and hostage release talks. Meanwhile, a panel of United Nations experts say famine has spread across the Gaza Strip and are accusing Israel of carrying out a targeted starvation campaign. Tariq Jasarevic is a spokesperson for the WHO, World Health Organization.
34 people have died of malnutrition and dehydration so far. And then Kamal Adwan Hospital alone, 60 cases of severe acute malnutrition were detected last week.
He warns malnutrition weakens the immune system, as destroyed sanitation infrastructure in Gaza has led to the spread of disease. This as Israel ramps up strikes in Gaza, bombing 4 United Nations-run schools in the last 4 days, killing dozens of Palestinians, mostly women and children, according to eyewitnesses. The latest strikes Tuesday killed 31 Palestinians near Khan Yunis and wounded some 50 others. It was condemned by the United Nations. In the U.S., Democrats say they'll bring up legislation to counter the recent Supreme Court ruling granting presidents broad immunity from prosecution. Catherine Carley reports.
We're doing this because we believe that in America, no president should be free to overturn an election against the will of the people, no matter what the conservative justices may believe.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats will introduce a bill to classify former President Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 election as unofficial acts. The move would strip Trump of criminal immunity the Supreme Court just granted to presidents. The White House says it's also considering how to respond to the court's unprecedented ruling. Meanwhile, Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is asking the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel to investigate Justice Clarence Thomas. Whitehouse says Thomas may have violated federal tax or ethics laws when he accepted luxury gifts from Republican megadonors.
If a justice isn't reporting income on his legally required financial disclosure, there's a good chance that something is amiss with his tax reporting as well.
He also wants the DOJ to investigate a $300,000 loan to Thomas that was forgiven. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
President Joe Biden's welcomed heads of state from dozens of European nations for NATO's 75th anniversary in Washington, D.C. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Joe Biden praised NATO as the single greatest defensive alliance in the world, crediting it with preventing war, protecting democracy, and defending against aggression. And he boasted of a growing NATO, with Finland and Sweden joining, and more member nations increasing their military spending.
It's good that we're stronger than ever, because this moment in history calls for our collective strength. Autocrats want to overturn global order, which is by and large kept for nearly 80 years and counting. Terrorist groups continue to plot evil schemes to cause mayhem and chaos and suffering.
In particular, Biden praised NATO for rising to the defense of Ukraine against the Russian invasion.
And we know Putin won't stop at Ukraine, but make no mistake, Ukraine can and will stop Putin.
NATO critics from around the world gathered in Washington, D.C. for a two-day summit called No to NATO, Yes to Peace. Sheen Kim is with the Democratic Socialists of America's International Committee.
So the heads of state of 32 NATO countries are coming to Washington, D.C. to tell us about the warmongering that they're going to be doing in the next years. And we are here to say no.
Speakers blasted NATO for military interventions in Yugoslavia, Libya, and Afghanistan, and for what they describe as escalating the war in Ukraine. I'm Christopher Martinez.
A death toll from Hurricane Beryl is now at least 10, 9 in the Houston area, 1 in Louisiana. And the return of searing heat in Texas has deepened the misery of people still without power. More than 1.7 million homes and businesses in Texas still lack electricity as of this morning. State officials have faced questions over whether the power utility that covers much of the area had sufficiently been prepared. The death toll from extreme heat in the West is nearing 24. In the Bay Area, Santa Clara County officials are investigating a dozen deaths as heat-related, including two at a homeless encampment. One person's died in Sacramento from the heat, two in Southern California, including a woman incarcerated in Chowchilla Prison. The death toll from the heat in Oregon is now 5. A child in Arizona has died while in a car. Las Vegas is forecasting to hit a 5th consecutive day of triple-digit heat, record-breaking hot temperatures of 115 degrees. Climate activists rallied in San Francisco Tuesday to bring attention to the banks that are financing fossil fuels, the main contributor to climate change. Ada Shaheen reports.
A nationwide coalition has organized the Summer of Heat put pressure on businesses and lawmakers to transition away from fossil fuels. Instead of going directly after those burning oil, gas, and coal, however, activists are targeting the money that supports those actors, big four banking culprits, Citi, Wells Fargo, Chase, and Bank of America. Activists say together those banks have invested $1.5 trillion into fossil fuels in the past 8 years. Claudia McDonough, with Thousand Grandmas, said Citi can shift investments to the renewable sector and earn just as much money.
The path is clear, but the pressure needs to keep mounting to convince the people who are stuck in the old ways.
In San Francisco, I'm Ata Shaheen, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
Republican officials in Montana will ask the state Supreme Court today to overturn a landmark climate ruling in a lawsuit brought by young people. Last year's decision said state regulators must consider global warming emissions when approving oil, gas, and coal projects. Legal experts say it must be upheld by the high court if it's to set a lasting legal precedent. Montana Republicans say emissions from the state's energy industry are insignificant and can't be blamed for climate change. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area today. A heat advisory goes in effect at 11 this morning to 8 p.m. Friday. Temperatures reaching the 90s, triple digits in inland valleys. In the Bay Area today, partial clouds this morning becoming sunny. Highs upper 70s to low 90s, reaching 104 degrees further inland like in Concord. In Fresno, an excessive heat advisory is in effect until Saturday night. Today, highs 107 degrees. I'm Christina Onnestead reporting for KPFA.
You're listening to Law & Disorder on KPFA. I'm Jesse Strauss. Since last year's downpours, fears of wildfire in California have been slightly further from the tips of many of our tongues, but the risk is here and it's humbling. The danger itself impacts us in a variety of ways, from our northern communities continuing to rebuild to our state working slowly to make plans for fire protection and mitigating dangers. Our guests today have published an article suggesting not only that our state is doing a bad job of mitigating wildfire risk, but that its strategies themselves are based in the logic and legacy of settler colonial American land grabs. Denise J. Martinez and Tony Marks Block, along with their other co-authors Bruno Serafin, Peter Nelson, and Kirsten Vignetta, propose that we prioritize wildfire mitigation by collaborating with indigenous communities to rekindle native cultural fire mitigation practices. Their article is called Indigenous Fire Futures: Anti-Colonial Approaches to Shifting Fire Relations in California.
Denise J. Martinez is a research administrator in the Native American Studies Department at UC Davis, where she researches collaborative governance, indigenous environmental justice, and fire management. She is a descendant of the Tutunaku people and grew up in Shasta and Karuk homelands in colonized Northern California. Tony Marksblock is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology, Geography, and Environmental Studies at Cal State East Bay in Hayward on unceded Chochenyo Ohlone territory. Tony's research is focused on the socio-ecology of small-scale subsistence practices, including prescribed and cultural fire. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
So, in this conversation, I want to start by identifying some of the problems, then look at what our indigenous communities are doing differently to mitigate wildfire risk, and we'll finish by exploring how we can look toward and work with our native neighbors for solutions. Let's start where we've arrived now in 2024 in terms of wildfire risk. The risk is real, and it's impacted communities in the whole region. On the one hand, especially now that we're getting some consistent rain, how serious are these risks? And on the other hand, how have our state's mitigation strategies made that risk worse?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we think about the state's approaches, historically, fire suppression has been a huge harm to the state of California. So we can see on the land that removing fire was a terrible management decision. It's led to a buildup of fuels that leads to the huge wildfires we see today. And I think that when you talk to the state, when you talk to federal agencies, they would actually agree with you. I think the issue now is that we've set up a system that favors fire suppression, that is built around that as a policy, and it's very difficult to get around that bureaucracy. I think the other thing is just that the problem has gone big to the scale where it is unmanageable for just state and federal agencies to be the ones to solve it. It's huge. It's we're talking about a ton of acres throughout the state and a lot of work involved in making sure that we steward those places responsibly. And really, the people that have done that at scale are indigenous communities who stewarded like that for a millennia, right? Since time immemorial, and were disturbed in those practices by settlers. And so, you know, that's one reason we turn to folks to learn about how that was done and how we can return to that.
Thank you, Denise. Tony, I want to bring you into the conversation. If you could kind of pick up some of where Denise left off in terms of what the specific legal and bureaucratic barriers to cultural fire are, and then we can start a conversation about what cultural burns actually look like and where that knowledge and those knowledges have come from historically.
Sure. So the system of fire suppression, as Denise pointed out, emerged in the early 1900s. And in addition to the fear and the racism, I think it's important to examine the role of the state in trying to protect timber in particular, and how the fear was in part oriented around fear of losing future profits by timber corporations, right? That are some of the largest landholders to this day in California. And so indigenous burning and prescribed fire, one of its effects is to kill small trees, right? And small trees are seen as future investments of timber capitalists. And so I think that is kind of the crux of the fear initially in the early 1900s. I also want to mention that when the Spanish first colonized as well, there was just an inherent fear toward indigenous burning because it was so, in part, so vital to indigenous livelihood. And so Spanish missionaries also had fire suppression policies that probably were not nearly as effective as the industrialized fire suppression apparatus that we see today. But nonetheless, the Spanish also, right, in those areas it had colonized primarily in coastal areas near the missions, outlawed fire by indigenous people. And since the expansion of what is called the wildland-urban interface, or I would say settlements, into parts of California that were less developed, there's a new fear that has emerged that motivates fire suppression policies, which is the protection of real estate in particular and structures in that interface of residential areas and what are known as wildlands or natural areas, forests, or grasslands and shrublands, right? And so this also is, you know, the fear of losing this these capital investments, I think, is a critical component of why suppression is such a prominent or impulsive response that is used today by the state of California and the federal government.
So these are fears that you're discussing, where cultural fire, at least in state responses, the fear is that cultural fire from indigenous communities has potential to impact. The older fear was timber industries, still here, still a present fear. And now, in addition to that, to protect real estate, it's really about capitalism here that we're talking about. Denise, can you bring us into what cultural fire, if we're referring to cultural fire, we're referring to controlled burns. What does that look like, and how does that actually relate to those fears? Is it putting those, I guess we can call them industries, timber and real estate, is it putting those industries at risk?
I think that when we think about cultural fire, I guess let's start at the beginning and say that cultural fire is a set of cultural fire knowledge and stewardship held by Indigenous people in California. Each community has a different way to approach cultural fire and cultural stewardship and cultural knowledge around fire. People are stewarding different plants, different ecosystems, and so fire looks very different in each community. But fire was integral to Indigenous livelihoods. And so you heard Tony say that. Basically, what that means is that fire was essential to making sure that food plants were producing well, that basketry and fiber plants that were used for material culture, you know, like clothes and housing and, you know, everything from jewelry and ceremony, regalia, all of these things relied on fire being a part of the landscape in order to have not just sufficient resources, but an abundance of resources. And Indigenous economy was based on the well-being of all species. And that's a very general statement because there's a lot of different ways that people approach that. But so when we look at the settler worries about timber and then now about real estate, we see that with timber, like Tony said, like it does threaten to some extent those small trees, and it did potentially lead to less profits for the timber industry to consistently burn and to keep healthy stands throughout the forest. I would also say that Indigenous people use wood. Like that was not necessarily a, you know, it wasn't a threat to human use of wood. It was a threat to capital profit off of the use of wood. That's what I think about the timber industry. In terms of today, in our worries about real estate, I think that Indigenous fire is, and Indigenous fire practitioners are very conscious of people's homes, people's livelihoods, and just trying to maintain safety for communities. I also think it's important to note that, like, people are not necessarily building real estate in a fire safe way. And these, you know, often are second homes that are in a really beautiful place in the forest, maybe on top of a ridgeline. And it's like, I think that there's such a disconnection from the function of a forest, from the role of fire in that forest. And it's causing us to make really dangerous decisions with where we put homes and structures. And I think that that's the threat there is wildfire and not necessarily prescribed or cultural fire, because there's a lot of things that you can do with prescribed and cultural fire to ensure safety. Not the case with wildfire. You know, I think that that connection to fire and land is important for everyone to learn about, because it causes us to make decisions differently about how we live our lives and where we live our lives. And that's a part of it, is where you put your home. I don't know if Tony has more to add. I think that those are just two things that came up when you asked that question. It is a huge question.
Yeah, no, I think that's well put, Denise. I think also I would say, you know, you can, fire and structures are certainly compatible. And it's just a question of whether or not people in the privatized real estate system are willing to invest in taking care of and steward the forest in a way that accepts fire and welcomes fire onto the land, as well as indigenous peoples, right? The tendency, I think, is for private landowners to put up fences and make their space exclusive and not include indigenous peoples, for one, or the investment that is necessary to take care of the land, which includes, you know, a lot of restorative work due to the dramatic ecological changes that have occurred associated with fire suppression and exclusion on the landscape. So as it exists, right, people who own homes and land in California can contribute to the solution by actually restoring fire to the landscape alongside indigenous peoples, right? With indigenous leadership at the helm. And of course, in many circumstances, returning lands back to indigenous peoples so that they can steward the lands, right? But homes can be on the landscape in certain circumstances. They always have been. It's just a question of whether or not fire is applied to the landscape in a very deliberate and careful way, which is what we learn from indigenous practices that are continue to this day. And you're listening to Law and Disorder on KPFA. We're in conversation with Denise J. Martinez and Tony Marks Block, who've published a recent article called Indigenous Fire Futures: Anti-Colonial Approaches to Shifting Fire Relations in California. We'll talk about some of those solutions that Tony's referring to in just a few minutes, but I want to continue to break down one more piece of the puzzle of the problem with California wildfire mitigation strategies. In your article, you described a term that's colloquially used in Caddo country, in what we know as Northern California, as the colonial fire military industrial prison complex. I'm wondering if one of you can break down that term and bring us into the conversation around particularly how the fire mitigation practices of our state relate to our prison industrial complex.
I guess I can start with the military part of it. When we think about fire suppression and how it's organized, so the, you know, the huge wildfires we see today often have military equipment. Firefighters are organized in a hierarchical way that's, you know, based on military terminology and response. I just recently took my coursework to get my red card, which would allow me to be on fires led by agencies. And the military terminology was everywhere. It was in every class. It was, they would divide us into groups and we would be, you know, Alpha, Charlie. So really, you know, it's a huge part of the culture. And it's also, you know, a result of the history of fire suppression, some of which, well, all of which was really violent towards Indigenous people and required a lot of conflict with Indigenous people. And so, you know, we're talking about militias and laws requiring violence against Indigenous people, starting fires. And all of this to say is that our firefighting system functions very much like a military. And in some cases, you know, I work with folks in agencies, I work with firefighters, and I respect the work that they do. And so, you know, I think to some extent, like some of the fires that we have today require an immense amount of coordination. And that, you know, again, the result of fire suppression and decisions that those agencies made in the past. But I always think that it's important to be critical of the language that we use, to be critical of agencies having that much power, for Indigenous communities to be able to push back on that sense of urgency that can happen on a fire. Because, you know, sometimes it leads to really destructive behaviors like bulldozing sacred sites or ruining village sites, all in the name of urgency and the wildfire. And I think it's important that Indigenous people be able to be in those spaces and to be able to slow things down. But I also think that that job is really difficult for the people that can be in those spaces because of this hierarchy and because of the way that it's militarized.
So we've spent quite a bit of time kind of identifying some of the various problems with California's fire mitigation plan or fire suppression plan. Moreover, let's bring it down. I mean, you all are kind of proposing a reframing of wildfire mitigation in California that looks at, learns from, focuses on, and builds with Indigenous communities. I'm wondering if you can bring us in for those of us who are listening and thinking, like, what are we talking about? Mitigating fire by lighting more things on fire? Can you bring us in by really like illustrating what these controlled and cultural burns look like, and what is the process that happens in those actual instances?
Yeah, so I can start by describing a prescribed burn as it would be done by an agency, and I think it can also, you know, be a helpful tool. But agencies right now are focused a lot on fuel mitigation or fuel reduction. And fuel is anything in a forest that can light on fire. And so you can think about how you would see, you know, like small shrubs, like leaves. And so you want to remove some of these smaller fuels so that your trees don't light on fire in case of a wildfire. You know, often these burns are focused mostly on that. And, you know, they're done by firefighters in, you know, a controlled setting, meaning that they have what we call lines where the fire will stop. And often these lines, you can think about them as roads, or maybe it's a river, or maybe it's, you know, a line that's mechanically been made with a bulldozer, or sometimes you can do it by hand using tools. And so we know going into a prescribed fire about where the fire will start and where it will end. And that is most of the case. That's exactly what happens. However, like, there's always a plan for an escape or some sort of like unexpected result. And so usually there's, you know, a plan for that too. So I think the difference between that and how Indigenous cultural burners might approach it is that the priorities are very different. So certainly fuel mitigation or fuel reduction can be a result of Indigenous fire, but the focus of Indigenous fire is cultural resources. It can be, you know, cultural processes, like who was involved, you know, did we have youth involved? Did we have elders involved? There is a bigger push to involve people of different abilities, parents, children, elders, and it's more inclusive in that way. There's also, I think, when we talk about focusing on cultural resources, there might be, you know, some plants that folks are really interested in supporting. There might be, you know, this might be a habitat of a specific animal. And so you start to kind of tailor it towards the needs of that animal. It's very, I think, thoughtful and holistic in the way that I've experienced it. And I think it's also the knowledge that cultural practitioners have of the land is just so much, makes me feel very safe. When I think about like creating lines, certainly those are safe, but when you burn with someone that's burned on the specific land or that knows a specific landscape, like the back of their hand, they've seen fire go through it multiple times at different intensities at different times of the year. All of a sudden, like, it's very clear that the plan that they have in their head is like exactly what's going to happen. And I don't, yeah. So, you know, those fires are just different in a lot of ways. And so both are quote unquote controlled in the sense that people have a plan going in and that plan usually pans out. I think with cultural burners, they might challenge the word controlled. They might say, we don't control our relatives. Fire is a relative. We're getting to know fire. We're here to learn from fire. We know that fire has a hunger and that fire, you know, that we can have conflict with fire. And people are aware of that, but it's, you know, fire is not the enemy. Seeing fire as a relative, you start to think very differently on the land and with your teammates. And, you know, you can start to see how that creates a different worldview to not, you know, be in a position of like fire is the enemy. We have to defeat it. We have to stop it. We have to make sure it doesn't get out of our control lines. And instead say like, okay, like what is fire doing? What are we learning? And I find that I learn a lot more about fire behavior and what fire looks like when I think in the way that my Indigenous mentors have told me to think.
And you're listening to Law and Disorder on KPFA. We're in conversation with Denise Martinez and Tony Marxblock, whose recent co-authored article is called Indigenous Fire Futures, Anti-Colonial Approaches to Shifting Fire Relations in California. For a framework where fire is not the enemy, as you just described, where fire is a relative, what does it mean to be exploring and taking part and doing these fires within the legal structures that we're in? I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how Native communities that are engaging in these practices have to interface with state agencies, and if there are moments or experiences where state agencies are actually embracing this as opposed to only being more restrictive.
I think that's exactly what causes a range of experiences around cultural burning. And I think it's also, you know, people talk about cultural burning being a small scale type of burning. I think that's a restriction set mostly by land jurisdiction and not necessarily a property of cultural burning, for lack of a better word. Certainly, Indigenous people have to interact with state and federal agencies often. I think the the places where I've seen Indigenous people burn in a more sovereign way are places that are either private land or maybe fee land on tribal lands. In other cases, there's always a interaction that has to happen with the state or federal agency that has jurisdiction. And so that can cause a lot of pain points because this is, you know, indigenous land, but under, you know, legal authority, under U.S. legal authority, it's actually, you know, U.S. Forest Service land, or it's, you know, California Parks land. And so I think that Indigenous people have been really good about creating new agreements with those agencies to co-steward land. They've been really good at pushing back against policy and creating new policies in California that support cultural burning. And I think that I give a lot of credit to those activists and those cultural burners that made that happen, because for a long time, cultural burning wasn't recognized the way that it is today. And I think that there's still a lot of work to be done. I think I have seen, you know, the state really step up in its trying to learn about cultural burning. I think there's still a lot of ways that the state could do better. And certainly, like, not every individual in the state knows about cultural burning, and that's an issue. But I've seen, you know, folks from Cal Fire come and burn at workshops with Ron Good. And what I love about that is that Ron, who is an elder and a cultural fire practitioner, he gives them, like, he teases the heck out of them. And it's so funny, but they take it. And I feel like it's led to a lot of learning. And I think that's, you know, in a lot of ways how the elders I know teach is through humor and through teasing and kind of poking at you. But I think it's led to a lot of relationship building. And again, I just commend people like Ron and others who are able to, despite all this hurt and frustration with state and federal agencies, they're still open to teaching, and they're still open to helping people learn. And I think to the extent that we can, it's, like, really important to show gratitude to the people that are still teaching, because it's, you know, it's hard, and it's work that requires a lot of grace and a lot of forgiveness and a lot of humor, apparently. But yeah, I don't know, Tony, if you had more to add.
We were seeing a shift, certainly, in terms of the state's interest in and acceptance of cultural fire and Indigenous people burning. At the same time, there remain very large obstacles in terms of, for example, statewide burn bans that occur across a very diverse climatic and ecological place that is now known as California. And so in numerous instances, just this last year, lots of Indigenous burners and prescribed burners have been shut down and have not been able to expand the practice of cultural and prescribed fire across the state. And so there still remains a very large amount of fear on the part of agencies, but also various industrial interests. Here in the Bay Area, for example, agricultural interests have a fear of fire and the smoke that it produces. And so I think that we have to learn or relearn that some smoke is better than the amount of smoke that we've experienced here in as a result of fire suppression, colonial fire suppression. And so there's a lot more barriers that need to be broken down. And yes, what Denise is talking about, those experiences where the agencies come and learn from Indigenous fire practitioners, that is a part of breaking down those barriers. That's where people become advocates for Indigenous fire.
because otherwise they may have some preconceived and racist notions toward what it is. It also involves, right, people being willing to let go of their power. That includes allowing access to those lands that indigenous peoples have been excluded from. So there's a lot more work to be done. And I think we're seeing the future, though, on a small scale in various places. And I would say that in the places I've worked in, Karuk and Yurok territories, the partnerships that exist between these different agencies, tribes, and NGOs run by indigenous people has allowed for large-scale transformation in terms of the frequency and scale of fire that is applied on the landscape. And I think also we have this fear of wildfire, but that is also a part of the ecology of California, right? We can't eliminate wildfire from the system either. We need to reconsider where we put structures and also reconsider whether or not we should be suppressing fire in those areas, in mountainous areas that are really remote, just in order to reduce smoke for people who live in cities. Instead, we should really be also considering investing in ways to protect people who are vulnerable in cities who already have respiratory issues due to industrial pollution exposure in places like Oakland, right? So creating that mitigation in people's homes, but also allowing fire to coexist on the landscape as it has for time immemorial, right? That's going to be the key moving forward, is learning how to accept that and not this knee-jerk response of putting it out, which has led to the disasters that we've experienced in the past decade.
So in your article, you all highlighted a few agreements between different tribal groups and different universities, and it seemed like you were approaching those agreements and relationships in a really positive light. I'm wondering if we can end by just highlighting some of those relationships on the Santa Cruz coast with the Amamatsun Land Trust. Denise, you already mentioned Ron Good, but working with the North Fork, Mono, and Southern Sierra Miwok tribes with UC and CSU students, and then the UC Berkeley Karuk Collaborative Research Project. Can we just very briefly highlight those to close us out today?
Sure. I think some of the work that has been done by academics has dispelled some of the notions that many folks have held about wildfire and indigenous burning historically and into the future. At the same time, I think, right, it's the folks on the ground that are making things happen. And so a lot of how resources flow in part in the state are to support research. And so as academics, I think it's really important to try and channel the resources presented to the university into those communities who really don't have access to resources in the same way as these institutions do. And so that's what all of these partnerships have tried to do. The Karuk UC Berkeley Collaborative has channeled resources to the Karuk tribe to support outstanding research questions that the tribe has. Same with the Amamutsun Land Trust and the Amamutsun Tribal Band. Folks from UC Berkeley have really supported that work, and by producing data that then state agencies are more likely to listen to. For better or for worse, many of these entrenched assumptions about what kind of knowledge is prioritized creates a lot of division, and also excludes indigenous fire practitioners. And so this is one way that we're trying to, I would say, circumvent some of these obstacles.
Yeah, and I guess I'll just talk a little bit more about Burning with Ron, who's been a really great mentor and just a good partner. So we get to work with Ron through a course at UC Davis on cultural burning called Keepers of the Flame, and been around for several years. And the really cool thing about it is that people like Ron or Diana Almendares, who's Wintun, have welcomed us onto the places where they burned to teach us about how they burn. And we've been able to support those workshops and support both Ron and Diana to, you know, bring other universities out to the workshops, to bring, you know, agency folks, folks who are policymakers or funders to come and learn from them. And I think what it's created is this really cool community of practice where we get to practice not just, you know, burning, which is certainly very important, like how to have a good relationship with fire, but really how to create a future where decision making is different, where learning and growing with Indigenous communities, following Indigenous priorities, how we can collaborate with each other through that lens. And so I think just having people come back year to year and engage and learn and, you know, get teased a little bit when they fail. I think it's all been just really healing and just like a vision into the future. It's like we're practicing what the future could look like on this, you know, smaller piece of land. And I think throughout the years, people have taken what they practiced there and created new programs for their tribe, new nonprofits, and, you know, students have gone on to work in a number of places for tribes, for, you know, Diana or Ron, or even, you know, in state and federal agencies in kind of these positions where they're the ones that know the most about Indigenous fire, because they spent, you know, years going to these workshops. They took dedicated time to think about cultural fire. And I think it's really empowering to see kind of not just what happens on the land, but how it kind of spreads from there, and how creating these, you know, communities of practice is really, it's just so impactful. Even though, you know, maybe the state would look at that and say, oh, it's only 5 acres that y'all are burning every year. And I would say, well, we've created something that's huge. And that's community, and that has the potential to really change California. And so, I don't know, I think it's beautiful to be able to learn from Ron, and I'm excited to go this year. So,
and maybe we can hope that the 5 acres this year can be expansive moving forward. I love what you described as practicing what the future could look like. And that's by looking toward and working with our Indigenous communities to decolonize wildfire practices. Denise and Tony, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Denise J. Martinez is a research administrator in the Native American Studies Department at UC Davis. She's a descendant of Tutunaku people and grew up in Shasta and Karuk homelands in colonized Northern California. Tony Marksblock is a professor in the Department of Anthropology, Geography, and Environmental Studies at Cal State East Bay and Hayward. Tony's research is focused on the socio-ecology of small-scale subsistence practices, including prescribed and cultural fire. Their recent co-authored article is called Indigenous Fire Futures: Anti-Colonial Approaches to Shifting Fire Relations in California. And a link to that article will be in the show notes for today's episode at kpfa.org. Our mission here on Law and Disorder is to expose, agitate, and build a new world where all of us can thrive. But how do we get there? How do we build a world many of us have only seen in our dreams? That's where we believe the artists come in. So the last few minutes of our show each day will feature a Resistance in Residence artist holding down a weekly residency with us, helping us to imagine a different, more liberated world. This week's Resistance in Residence artist is rhythm guitarist, orchestrator, composer, and producer Ella Rae Feingold. One of the ways you described
your earlier experience of picking up guitar and kind of diving into it, you said that you needed a mask to get through life, and guitar was that mask. Uh-huh. Wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what you meant by that.
I can. I mean, if it's appropriate to talk about for your listeners, but it's,
absolutely,
it's my humanity, so it's who I am. Yeah, I mean, so for those that don't know, I'm a transgender woman. And I knew who I was my whole life. I didn't get to live authentically until much later in life. And life was pretty unbearable back then, you know, because I wasn't able to live as who I actually am, you know, in my brain and in my soul and whatnot. So I just needed a way to get through life and sort of hide behind something. And music was a mask, and it quite literally kept me alive. You know, it was something I could seek refuge in and hold on to and comfort me. And it was also something I could just go down musical rabbit holes on in order to not have to deal with my life and what I was actually going through, you know? Yeah.
And your gender identity and the absolute clarity with which you speak about it. I mean, you were young, mm-hmm. when you knew this part of yourself, and, you know, there's all kind of legislation around the country attacking trans people.
Yeah.
And particularly focusing on young people. And I'm so glad that you were able to find some space of freedom within music as a kid, because you've brought so much music into this world that's been so great. But I'm also wondering if you ever think back on what it could have been like if there were room for you as a young person to really embrace your gender authentically.
You know, I actually try not to think about it because it's just painful. I just sort of feel like there are so many lost years, you know, of not getting to be me and sort of watching life pass me by. I mean, I do also sort of take comfort in that, you know, there's no wrong time to transition. It's never too late to be you. You know, it's never too late to start over. So I don't have regret transitioning when I did, but yeah, it's hard to think about, you know, what things could have been like back then, you know, if I was able to be accepted. And I just, you know, I'm 43 and I knew, you know, in the mid 80s. So I just feel like I would have probably had a really brutal life of being homeschooled and ostracized and in therapy and on medicine and people trying to understand why I'm a certain way. And it sort of says a lot about trans people, because here I am in the 80s, raised by heterosexual parents. I don't even know what the word trans is. I don't know any trans people. And yet I knew who I was very early on. I didn't know what the word was for it, but I knew something's not right and I'm not a boy. You know, so the moral of the story is, you know, people know and believe people when they tell you, you know, who they are. And this whole notion of people are too young to know. I mean, I knew around 5 and I just knew to my core. And I'm 43 years old now. I transitioned at 40. And a lot of people, you know, connect with me and feel a sense of comfort around me because I am who I am. And it sort of maybe gives them permission to be them. And I guess what I'd like to say for people that don't believe that trans kids exist is that I was a trans kid. I was one of those kids that you don't think knew who they were back then. And I'm telling you, I knew who I was.
Yeah.
And I'm here today, you know, just a woman in the world, just trying to do her best in the world, you know, spread some love through music and just have some joy. So
thank you so much for sharing that. I hope I didn't bring too much
happy to talk about it. I think it's important to talk about, you know, just because of all the crazy legislation and just the people trying to get other people to hate girls like me. You know, I think it's important to to normalize it and bring humanism to it. So you can actually get to actually talk to someone who's trans, because a lot of these people that pass legislation and hate people like me, they don't even know us. They've That's never right. taken the time to hear about our lives. And, you know, there was a quote from Mr. Rogers, and it was something yes. like, there's nobody, you know, you couldn't love once you've heard their story. And it's not his quote, but it was something that he said, and he got it from someone else. And I've just always thought about that, not only for my own life, but just for life in general. And, you know, hey, this is part of my story. So I hope you could love me for it.
And I absolutely love your Mr. Rogers reference point. He was a big impact on many of us who grew yeah. up in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, yeah. He's so wonderful.
I also wanted to ask about your experience as a touring musician and, you know, making a decision to transition in other ways. Of course, you knew about your own gender identity, mm-hmm. but I know that often in musical spaces where there's a lot of men around, mm-hmm. that there's a lot of like hyper masculine conversations.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you'd be comfortable talking at all about what that experience was like for you, being aware of yourself not fitting into the same kind of body that some of those other musicians were in, that kind of musician culture.
Yeah. I mean, I think because I had music, I could hide behind a lot of things, like I said earlier. So, you know, this sort of, I don't know, fragile or toxic masculinity that I would experience, you know, just sort of the patriarchy in general, it bothered me. It made me feel uncomfortable, but I sort of just had music to hold on to. And I could also just sense that all of those things just came from a place of not knowing who they were, you know?
Yeah.
And I certainly see that magnified today by the people, you know, that don't like me, because it's very much not about me, because they don't even know me, you know? So you couldn't possibly hate me, because if you don't know me. So just with those types of those things, I mean, even back then, I just knew that's about you. That's not about me.
And that was the voice of this week's Resistance in Residence artist, transgender rhythm guitarist, orchestrator, composer, and producer Ella Rae Feingold, who's toured and recorded with the who's who of modern black music, including Queen Latifah, Erykah Badu, The Roots, Jay-Z, Corinne Bailey-Ray, Eric Benet, Silk Sonic, which is Anderson .Paak and Bruno Mars, and many more. Ella joins us for the last few minutes of each of our shows this week as our Resistance in Residence artist, and you can listen to our full-length conversation with Ella on our podcast, which is linked from our social media, that's at Law and Dis, D-I-S, or from our website at kpfa.org, where you can also donate to support KPFA's programming. That's it for the day, family. Law and Disorder airs weekdays at 8 a.m. Check for information about topics, guests, and featured artists online at kpfa.org. Listen and subscribe to the podcast version of the show by searching for Law and Disorder with Kat Brooks, and follow us on social media at Law and Dis. You can hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. A big thanks to the squad. Our engineer today is Kirsten Thomas. Show theme music is from Steve Raskin. I'm your host and producer, Jesse Strauss. Kat Brooks is on vacation. If you're incarcerated and want to send us a letter, you can write to Law and Disorder, care of Kat Brooks, KPFA, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94704. We will occasionally read your letters on the air. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Democracy Now! Is up next at 9 o'clock.
Pacifica National Board and the KPFA Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica Bylaws Amendment between July 10th and August 24th of this year. For more information on the amendment and about how vacancies are filled on the local station boards and about the process, go to the pacifica.org website.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley.
88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248DR in Santa Cruz, 94.3 K232FZ in Monterey, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.